This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death toll from over 5 months of the Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza keeps rising, now nearing 32,000. A new UN imagery report shows 35% of the buildings in the Gaza Strip have been destroyed by Israel's genocidal campaign. And the pressure on halting arms export to Israel gains more momentum, as the UK is considering to set conditions for sending weapons to the Tel Aviv regime. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Over 5 months into the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the regime's relentless bombardment and shelling continue to claim innocent lives in the besieged Palestinian territory. Over 100 Gazans have lost their lives in Israeli strikes since Wednesday. Several areas, including Jabalia in the north and Rafah in the south, have come under fresh shelling and aerial strikes. The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza since October the 7th is now closer to 32,000, most of them women and children. Meanwhile, the Israeli army has also warned the displaced people in Al-Shifa Hospital to leave the complex immediately. Palestinian media reported that the military also blew up a building used as critical care unit there. Israeli forces attacked the hospital at the weekend, killing and injuring a number of people while kept laying siege to the compound. On Wednesday, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas released a footage showing its fighters repelling an Israeli attack near Al-Shifa. The video shows resistance fighters targeting invading troops and a tank with rockets and hand grenades. The UN's Satellite Center has released an updated assessment of the damage inflicted on buildings in the Gaza Strip. It says that 35% of all buildings in the Gaza Strip have been damaged. UNOSAT said that nearly 90,000 buildings have been damaged, among which around 32,000 have been completely destroyed. The new assessment shows that nearly 20,000 buildings have been damaged in the Gaza Strip since the previous assessment in January. Israel's indiscriminate bombings of the besieged territory have resulted in the destruction of hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, and civilian infrastructure. Such destruction of homes and other essential areas has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Human rights organizations say the destruction appears to be aimed at or has the effect of rendering the return of civilians to these areas impossible. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is profoundly distressing. Continuous Israeli bombings on civilian areas have left people without shelter. Let's take a listen to harrowing accounts of some of the displaced.
There is U.S. support, European support, and support of the whole world with Israel. They support them with weapons and planes. They mock us and send 4 or 5 airdrops just to save their faces.
We were sleeping a while before pre-dawn meal. However, they bombarded the place. We are displaced persons from the north. We are not affiliated with any political party. No safe place is being left across Gaza.
I am saying this to the whole world. They can see what Israel is doing to the poor Palestinian people. We have been under bombings for 6 months. They are children. What have they done to deserve this? We are tired. We no longer have energy. The children in the south and the north are dying of hunger. What has a baby done to die of hunger?
Sheet metal panels, rubble, and the stones have fallen on my husband. God protected my daughter. I pulled her out from the bathroom. The metal panels and rubble from the adjacent building collapsed on us. Thanks God we survived.
It is Mother's Day across the Arab world. In Palestine, however, mothers are not celebrating this event as they are facing death, displacement, starvation, and abduction. The Palestinian Prisoners Society says the Israeli forces have carried out large-scale detention campaigns against women in the Gaza Strip since the start of the regime's onslaught on the besieged territory early in October. The PPS explained the crimes and violations committed by the Israeli forces against female prisoners have escalated in an unprecedented way. The Prisoners' Society said Palestinian mothers in Israeli jails are not allowed visitors on Mother's Day. According to UN Women, over 9,000 Palestinian women have been killed by Israeli forces since October, with an estimated 37 mothers losing their lives every day. Israel's relentless massacres in the Gaza Strip are sparking a deepening rift between the regime and its closest allies. Now the UK has conditioned the continuation of arms sales to Israel on granting access to the Red Cross to visit Hamas forces detained by the regime. London argues that Tel Aviv is violating the international law by refusing to share detainee lists and to allow Red Cross visits. The British Foreign Secretary David Cameron has also warned of a wider weapons embargo by Europe if the regime continues with its genocidal war on Gaza. The threat comes on the heels of a recent decision by Canada to impose an arms ban on Israel over its violations of the international law in Gaza. The UK has also been witnessing nationwide pro-Palestine demonstrations. In one such rally, hundreds of Britons shut down arms factories across England and in Scotland to condemn the country's complicity in the Israeli genocide against Palestinians. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza has caused a huge public outcry around the world, with calls getting louder to boycott or to impose sanctions on the occupying regime. Western countries have so far refused to heed those calls from their own citizens. They also continue to show their double standards by blacklisting those who extend support to the oppressed Palestinians, but at the same time supplying the Israeli regime with arms and money to keep spilling the blood of Palestinians. Press TV discussed the issue with Sayed Mohammad Marandi, a university professor and political analyst in Tehran. Let's take a listen.
Genocide in Gaza is clear for everyone to see. Even in the West, people are increasingly recognizing the fact that the Israeli regime is carrying out a Holocaust. But as you rightly pointed out, the ban against the Russians or Belarus or others has been put in place not only by bodies linked to sports, but also all other institutions, European institutions and elsewhere. The Russians are punished, but the Israelis are not punished. The Israeli regime is not sanctioned. Only a handful of people in the West Bank, settlers, have been sanctioned, and that's for show. But whole entire countries are sanctioned by the Europeans and the Americans. Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and Yemen. Other countries have been completely destroyed. Russia also sanctioned. But the Israeli regime, despite carrying out this genocide, despite it going on for months, and despite it being the first genocide to take place in front of the eyes of the global community, the West is doing nothing to stop it.
The Israeli regime has conducted fresh raids on different areas across the West Bank. Four Palestinians are killed in Tokar and another killed in Ramallah during the incursions, bringing the death toll in the last 24 hours to 9. Earlier we spoke to our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil on the seemingly unending Israeli violence in the occupied territories.
Last night was yet another bloody night here in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli forces killed two more Palestinians in Nur Shams refugee camp during military raid and taking death toll in Nur Shams refugee camp in Tul Karem to 4, where the Israeli military had already conducted an airstrike at a group of Palestinians, and they killed two Palestinians there. The Israeli military claimed they were preparing to carry out anti-Israeli operations inside the lands occupied in 1948. Later, the Israeli forces raided Nur Shams refugee camp. Exchange of fire continued for several hours, and only in less than half an hour, the Israeli forces left Tul Karem refugee camp after killing two more Palestinians. You have to mention that in addition to those four Palestinians who were killed in Nur Shams refugee camp, the Israeli military had already had also conducted another airstrike earlier in Jenin refugee camp and killed three Palestinians. So it seems that we are speaking about nine Palestinians were killed in the last 24 hours in northern the occupied West Bank, in the center of the occupied West Bank, and in southern the occupied West Bank.
The European Council President Charles Michel has called on the European Union to prepare for war and to enhance its military capabilities amid escalating tensions with Russia over the war in Ukraine. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
The recent European Council President Charles Michel's warning that the European Union needs to ramp up its military production and shift to a war economy mode in response to an alleged threat posed by Russia has sparked international alarm and mixed reactions in Europe. Earlier this week, Michel wrote in an opinion editorial run by a media specialized in EU affairs that if Europe wants peace, it must prepare for war, arguing that although the EU's military manufacturing capacity has increased by 50% since the start of the Ukraine-Russia war in 2022, far more was needed.
Our European awakening is just beginning to take shape, and I would like to tell you what I feel. The time has come to create a real union of defence coupled with a true defence single market.
Michel added that the European Union must finally take responsibility for its own security. For decades, the European Union has relied heavily on the United States and the Western military alliance NATO for its security. Analysts believe that the dependency on external powers by the 27-member bloc has resulted in a complete loss of its own geopolitical and strategic autonomy.
In questo momento,
at this point in time, the EU cannot be militarily independent. It can't adopt autonomous strategies. Today, Europe must create its own defense system so that in 30 years' time, it can really be geopolitically autonomous. If we continue to put national interests ahead, all individual states, including Italy, would lose geopolitical relevance.
Michel's remarks come as Ukrainian and international politicians and experts are warning that ammunition shortages are resulting in the losses of territory to Russia.
Michel is trying to keep Germany under pressure, demanding together with the French government that Berlin provide Ukraine with long-range cruise missiles Taurus. German Chancellor Scholz has so far said no to this request to avoid a war escalation, adding that his country has already provided Kiev with arms for 7 billion euros, while France is struggling to pay for Ukraine military aid.
On Wednesday, the Italian former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte accused the current Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni of dragging Italy into World War III after having turned the country into an irrelevant, subjugated power. Max Civilli, Rome.
Workers across France have walked off their jobs demanding higher pay to offset enduring inflation. It was the first labor action featuring the nation's top eight unions, indicating looming trouble for the administration of President Emmanuel Macron. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
France's unions united for a massive nationwide strike to demand higher wages in the face of prolonged record inflation. In the past 2 years, the annual inflation rate has combined to reach 10% in France. However, in that same time frame, public sector workers have been given raises which add up to only 5%. As 6 million people work for the government, that means 21% of all workers and their household dependents have been suffering economically since inflation began to soar above the unofficial limit of 2% since way back in August 2021.
Everyone here is working for the same goal, to serve our population and to provide them with free government services of good quality. All workers need their wages to improve immediately, and this is undeniable.
Last month, the government added 10 billion euros in new budget cuts to the already austerity 2024 annual budget. They even warned more cuts are coming soon, meaning workers should expect even less help from the government.
How can we attempt the same failed cure of austerity again? When you don't have food, the cure to your hunger isn't to reduce the amount of food on your plate. It's the same with money. When everyone has seen their savings decrease, the solution is not to make us even poorer.
When we had the 2008 crisis, the government had this song, the same in Britain, the same in every country, saying that Yeah, we need to make a collective effort to really support the banks that did cheat with the subprimes and everything. And the people did. They at the time, they believed in this speech. 10 years after, more than 10 years, the same song doesn't grasp in the mind of people. People, they don't want to be fooled again.
After a 55% tax rate, the second highest in Europe, the average public sector worker takes home 2,400 euros a month. Government data shows that in the decade between 2011 and 2021, private sector salaries increased twice as fast as salaries in the public sector.
The first major union-led demonstration of the year has a familiar ring to it. Austerity cuts on top of painful inflation, which is still running at 3%. The government insists that austerity will start working finally, but France's striking workers appear unconvinced. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who
The Zionist regime's prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke recently by video link to an APAC summit taking place just outside Washington, D.C. APAC attendees applauded his pursuit of genocide in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinians have been martyred, neighborhoods wiped out, and the Zionist regime military has overseen starvation policies, now taking the lives of Palestinian children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Netanyahu has received the staunch support from President Joe Biden. The American president has noted some reservations at times, expressing consternation at the Zionist regime's indiscriminate bombing and over-the-top conduct in Gaza. But so far, Biden has kept the weapons flowing to Israel. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is most unlikely to stop the delivery of weapons now that Yoav Gallant, the Zionist regime's war minister, has signed a letter to the Biden administration with empty assurances that the weapons will be used in accordance with international law and that the U.S. humanitarian aid will be allowed into Gaza. This was, after all, already supposed to be the case. According to the Washington Post, the U.S. has approved and delivered more than 100 separate foreign military sales to Israel since October 7th, including thousands of precision-guided munitions, small-diameter bombs, bunker busters, small arms, and other lethal aid. For re-election purposes, Biden understands to say one thing, while quietly belying the words with actions facilitating the Zionist regime's war crimes. Biden's weekend comment about a red line on an Israeli invasion of Rafah, the last so-called safer area for Palestinians in Gaza, appears meaningless. He immediately self-corrected to note, "I'm never gonna leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical," unquote. Netanyahu, for his part, wasn't having even a little of it, declaring, "We will go there." He added, "You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7 doesn't happen again, never happens again," unquote. Red lines about the Zionist regime's apartheid and war crimes, however, are scarcely broached by mainstream Western media. The Zionist regime's prime minister continued with a similar line of thinking at AIPAC, pocketing Biden's support and indicating he would nevertheless do what he wants with American weapons. He said, "I deeply appreciate it, the support we've received from President Biden and the administration, and I hope it will continue. But let me be clear, Israel will win this war no matter what." The key words, though, unbelievable, are these: "We will finish the job in Rafah while enabling the civilian population to get out of harm's way. We've taken measures to minimize civilian casualties that no other army has taken in history." Yet those supposed measures involve the killing of well over 12,000 Palestinian children. Even if CNN couldn't bring itself to note clearly and repeatedly that the Zionist regime is the power killing them in a recent segment on Palestinian children. Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, also speaking recently, said that the path to securing stability for Israel does not lie in smashing into Rafah, where there are 1.3 million people, in the absence of a credible plan to deal with the population there. And again, as things stand today, we have not seen what that plan is. But he refused to speculate on whether the U.S. would condition military aid to Israel if Netanyahu disregards Biden's mealy-mouthed warning and attacks Rafah and the Palestinians seeking limited safety there. In other words, if hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have faced 5 months of bombing and deprivation are not moved out of Rafah before an Israeli regime offensive, then the Biden administration may or may not take action regarding weapons to Israel. It's all words with no meaningful consequences as of yet, except that key constituencies are abandoning Biden and the Democratic Party. And if Palestinians are moved to the north, where the bombed and destitute are starving, the Biden administration is signaling that would be acceptable in the midst of what the International Court of Justice has deemed a plausible genocide by the child killer regime of Israel. AIPAC lobbyists spend part of their day pushing for additional military aid from the U.S. in order for the Zionist regime to prosecute the Gaza genocide unencumbered by a weapons shortage. Code Pink activists were there to challenge them. At least one irate AIPAC lobbyist ripped up a photo of starving Palestinians. Another argued that the Zionist regime could have turned Gaza into a parking lot had it wanted to do so and was rightly told that it had done so. Congressman Max Miller, in fact, early in the assault on Gaza, called for turning it into a parking lot. And AIPAC lobbyists attempt to get Code Pink activists thrown out for exercising their First Amendment rights in trying to stop a genocide. Code Pink co-founder Media Benjamin told the Electronic Intifada that while they weren't thrown out of the Capitol building, they were forced from the grounds. Benjamin wrote in a message, "There is a vast chasm between what the president says and what he is doing, just like thanks to AIPAC. There is a vast chasm between what the American people want, a ceasefire and no more weapons to Israel, and what Congress is doing." The response to Code Pink activists made clear that genocide promotion in Gaza is going and being pursued by AIPAC lobbyists seeking more U.S. weapons for the Zionist regime's ongoing bombing and decimation of the coastal strip of territory and its people. Yet many Democratic candidates continue to embrace the financial support of AIPAC's Super PAC, United Democracy Project, and are likewise complicit in the Zionist regime's actions in Gaza. Even Politico, apparently beholden, though not yet pledged, to a code of conduct supporting the right of existence of the Zionist regime, even as an apartheid regime that is carrying out genocide in Gaza, has acknowledged that AIPAC is expected to spend $100 million across its political entities in 2024. Taking aim at candidates they deem insufficiently supportive of the Zionist regime. In 2024, many Democrats are proudly taking AIPAC's money to undercut candidates who would actually do what Americans want, back a ceasefire.
Covering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? There is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet, death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop, that would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died, and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death, or where did they go? So it's a transition for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
Cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity. And death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from, and that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved. Meaning that, you know, a man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا
نزلا من عند الله.
Death is an astonishing path through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ. And they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase. Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The
whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls, we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure. But the person, no. The person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is. What is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْرُوحِ قُلِ الْرُوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering, and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay? So you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay? It's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, what we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts. And there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into Barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book, Masnavi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters. 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.